From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Heading into World War II, cork was essential in planes, ships, subs, and countless other tools of war. When a year's supply of cork went up in flames at Crown Cork and Seals factory in Highlandtown, it was a threat to national security.
There were FBI agents covering the scene afterwards, and the newspaper accounts over the days said there were rumors of Nazi sabotage. And in the atmosphere of that time, this was a very serious charge.
David Taylor's book about the crucial commodity and the families whose lives it changed is called Cork Wars. Plus, David London of the Peale Center for Baltimore History and Architecture tells about an immersive exhibit that transports visitors back in time 200 years to the studio of the museum's founder. All on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Surrounded as we are by synthetics and plastics, it's hard to imagine that as armies geared up for World War II 8 decades ago, the substance they worried about was cork. Spongy, nondescript cork. Far beyond just stoppering bottles, cork was crucial for gaskets in bomber planes, insulation in submarines, and countless other tools of war. Baltimore was home to a powerhouse in the cork industry, Crown Cork and Seal. But all the supply of cork came from overseas around the Mediterranean and was vulnerable to America's enemies. That's the background to a fascinating tale spun by David A. Taylor called Cork Wars, Intrigue and Industry in World War II. He'll be speaking about it Saturday at the Creative Alliance. Later in the show, we'll delve into another era, a new exhibit, part puzzle, part performance, that promises to transport visitors to the Peale Center for Baltimore History and Architecture back to 1819. But first, World War II, Baltimore industry and international intrigue. David Taylor teaches science writing at Johns Hopkins University, and he's here with me in the studio. Welcome to On the Record.
Thanks so much, Sheila.
You start Cork Wars with a vivid description of a huge fire in 1940. What happened?
At the Baltimore plant of Crown Cork and Seal, the inventory of cork in the stockyard went up in flames, and it was consumed 9 acres of cork. It was a huge 15-alarm fire, burned for 2 nights. You could see it from Annapolis and from Philadelphia, and it was beyond just a spectacle of being the largest fire anyone could remember. It was also potentially a victim of sabotage. There were FBI agents covering the scene afterwards, and the newspaper accounts over the days said there were rumors of Nazi sabotage. And in the atmosphere of that time, this was a very serious charge.
And they thought there might be sabotage because cork was such an essential element for the war.
That's right. The fire, as Charles McManus Jr. told me, the fire was really what put them on the notice of the national security system. It exposed the vulnerability that the U.S. relied on this foreign supply for nearly half the world's production of cork, and really all of the cork that the U.S. used, both for commercial and defense purposes.
You build this history, which reads with all the suspense of a novel, around three families, and one is the McManus family, which owned Crown Cork and Seal. Introduce us to Charles McManus Sr.
Charles McManus Sr. was a fascinating Baltimore figure. He grew up, his father was a construction worker, and when Charles was in school, he was a victim of a gun accident that put out his eye. So he couldn't go to school anymore from the shrapnel and the medical problems that resulted from that. But he was smart, and he still wanted to be an inventor. So he put himself through night school of inventing in New York. He dedicated himself to finding a better sealant using cork. And within 20 years, he was at the top of the cork industry and had bought out Crown Cork and Seal and was back in Baltimore and was really expanding through the bottle caps that used cork in the sliver in the top seal, new ways to use this cork and this what he called composition cork, a kind of a granulated product that was really flexible and expanded the uses of cork.
Another star of Cork Wars is Frank de Cara, son of Italian immigrants, who was 13 when the Crown Cork Inventory burned in that huge fire. He could see the flames from his family's house on East Pratt Street in Highland Town. Let's hear part of what Frank de Cara told you.
And he met my mother on the ship. They decided Baltimore to be a place where they're going to live. Liam bought a house in Holland Town for $500. I remember it was like living in Holland Town, growing up in an Italian family. My father worked on the railroad for $2 a day. He'd come home all exhausted. My mother went to bed hungry sometimes at night.
Why is Frank de Cara part of Cork Wars?
Frank de Cara comes from the neighborhood around the factory. Everyone in the community had someone who worked at Crown Cork and Seal. And more than that, they were also, as Italian-Americans and as immigrants generally, they were vulnerable to any changes of work or suspicions about job performance that would come up. Frank's story then connects again later with Crown Cork in several ways. I mean, he has to go to work during the war and is...
He had three brothers.
That's right. He had three older brothers, and they were all taken into the service. And after his father died, it was really Frank was the only male child to be around to help make ends meet.
And then he was drafted. So he's off in the Philippines fighting. He comes home.
Yeah, first he works for a wartime plant. He gets drafted, is taken off to the Philippines, comes home, and then, like many veterans, couldn't find a job. Eventually, he ran into a former supervisor at the plant where he had worked during the war was unclear because it was a wartime factory. He wasn't exactly sure that he was working for Crown Cork and Seal. He might have been working, he thought, for Glenn Martin's company because he was making bomber wings. But in the end, a former supervisor said, come in on Monday and we'll get you a job.
Let me probe that a little bit. He was surprised because he's a teenager. He's got a job putting the drill holes into huge airplane wings. And his paycheck says he's being paid by Crown Cork and Seal. This was an example of how McManus had expanded the business of Crown Cork and Seal, right? This was an example of how Charles McManus Sr. had put this cork company into the middle of defense work.
That's right. And it was an example. It wasn't just McManus in that case. During the start of the war, many companies were scrambling to, how do we adapt to these? Our supply lines have been cut. Materials are more expensive. What do we do to make ends meet ourselves? Crown Cork and Seal found a way to make it work with defense contracts. Other cork companies too, like Armstrong Cork in Pennsylvania, they also took on defense contracts making armaments. So there were a lot of adaptations, and these factories didn't have names on them because it was adapted fast. A lot of the workers didn't know who they were working for exactly.
That's David Taylor, who teaches science writing at Johns Hopkins. We're talking about his new book, Cork Wars, Intrigue in Industry in World War II. He'll be at the Creative Alliance Saturday afternoon to discuss the book and several short films that illustrate it. Another drama that drives Cork Wars is Charles McManus Sr.'s efforts to grow cork in the U.S. Why did he think that was possible?
There were a couple of factors that made McManus want to try to grow trees nationwide. And he didn't really think it was entirely possible until he was on a trip in California visiting his West Coast affiliate. And in 1939, they were out in the Napa Valley, and he saw a familiar-looking tree, and he asked the driver to stop. They cut off a piece of the bark, said, that looks like a cork tree. And it turned out they sent the bark back for analysis in Baltimore, and it was cork. It was trees that had been growing, unbeknownst to many Californians of the later generations, during the Mexican era in the mid to late 1800s, there had been a number of cork trees planted in California and evidently adapted to the American climate. So that's what gave McManus the idea that maybe they could grow their way out of this dependence on a foreign supply of this crucial material.
You document very elaborate research efforts that McManus funded, and there was also sort of a victory garden aspect to his drive to create American source of cork. Just tell us about that.
That's right. McManus was very much a hands-on type of person and with the idea of vendors. So rather than make speeches or even do war bonds for the war effort, he wanted to make the cork growing campaign something that everyone could be part of. So he sponsored Arbor Day celebrations with state governors giving speeches, but then taking a shovel and planting cork seedlings on the state capitol grounds in Annapolis and a dozen other states. And 4-H kids and garden clubs and foresters were planting these seedlings of from cork acorns to raise millions of cork oak trees.
Which would have taken years to actually yield usable cork.
That's right. It was a long-term investment. It would have been 10 years before they saw any return from that. So the idea that a tree-growing campaign during the war would make it a contribution was a long shot.
I want to loop back to Frank DeCara. Another drumbeat of cork wars is the way America treated Italian immigrants during World War II. So many were declared enemy aliens. Tell us about that.
Yes, that's something that's mostly forgotten. And it was even in the months leading up to Americans' entry into the war, it was clear that Italy and Germany were going to be our enemies. And the FBI even drew up a list of people from German and Italian backgrounds who would be rounded up with minimal rationale in the event that war was declared. And after Pearl Harbor and after the U.S. declared war on Germany and Italy, Italian Americans were suddenly under suspicion that they were assumed to be loyal to their motherland. And so particularly older Italian Americans were really caught by this bind and felt obligated to show their patriotism, but still government agencies were detaining and relocating thousands of Italian Americans if they were too close to defense facilities, if they were too close to the coast. And many lost their livelihoods too. Fishermen lost their boats because they were considered suspect.
Did that affect the DeCara family?
It did affect the DeCaras. Like millions of others, particularly at the beginning of the war, they had to register as enemy aliens with the post office. And Frank talks about how his father's shortwave radio got taken by government agents when they were suspecting them of having some communication directly with Italy.
Why did you think it was important to include this history in this book about industry and foreign intrigue?
I wanted the book to show this experience of Americans at across a range that we don't typically see when we read about World War II. We often read just about the war campaigns or on the battlefield or even in the spy networks. But this was an experience that many Americans of that time went through. And it was covered up by for decades out of fear and shame. It's important to bring those up, especially now as we have some of those same elements of fear causing these dynamics and suffering for immigrants.
Did they ever find out what caused the fire, the big fire?
There was an investigation, as the book shows, and it goes follows several points of how the FBI received informants information about the fire. But in the end, they reckoned with the fact that fire forensics at that point was still early on, and often a fire consumed all the evidence about what went into it. So the question of whether the fire was sabotage or not still lingered.
And is Frank DeCaro still living?
Yes, Frank is thankfully still with us and still feisty.
I appreciate you walking us through it. Thank you so much. Congratulations on the book.
Thanks so much, Sheila. It was a pleasure.
David Taylor's new book is Cork Wars, Intrigue and Industry in World War II. He'll be in the Marquee Lounge at the Creative Alliance at 4 p.m. Saturday, January 26, along with documentary filmmaker Kylie Kraskuskas and researcher Amy Johansson to discuss the book and the short films. Next Thursday, January 31st, David Taylor will speak about Cork Wars in the Pratt Library's Writers Live series, 6:30 p.m. at the Maryland State Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, 415 Park Avenue in Baltimore. We've got more information at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. Short break now on the record, and then time travel at Baltimore's Peel Center. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Part puzzle, part performance. A whimsical new exhibit at the Peel Center for Baltimore History and Architecture takes visitors on a 200-year journey back in time so they can explore the study, the private room, of Rembrandt Peel, the artist who founded the museum. Opened in 1814, the Peel Center is the oldest building in America constructed to be a museum. From now until March, the Peel Center is offering this time travel tour. With us to talk about how it works is David London, Director of Operations at the Peel Center and creator of Time Travel Tours. Welcome to On the Record.
Thanks, Sheila. Thanks for having me.
Rembrandt Peel was only 17 years old when he painted his first of many portraits of George Washington. How did he come to open a museum?
Well, his father, Charles Wilson Peel, opened what is considered to be the first museum in America, and that was the Peel Museum in Philadelphia. But it occupied a pre-existing building, which is why we get to claim the Peel Center here in Baltimore as the first building built to be a museum. And his father was an amazing painter and had over 10 children who survived to adulthood, all of whom he not only taught to paint, but also destined them to be great painters by naming them after famous painters of the past. And because he opened this museum, he also cultivated in his children the love of the natural world. And he was existing at the very beginning of...
Because this was not just an art museum.
Correct. Yeah. So they displayed man-made wonders and natural wonders equally. And we have a few paintings on display at the Peel, which show the Charles Wilson Peel's great hall at his museum. And so they would display the natural history specimens that they collected just below portraits and sculptures of famous Americans. And so there was no differentiation yet in what we now call a natural history museum and an art museum. It was just a museum. And so his children sort of embodied this love of both art and man-made wonders and the natural world and natural wonders. And Rembrandt, against his father's advice, decided that he too wanted to open a museum. And Baltimore was a really transforming city at the time. There was a major influx of people coming through the city, and he thought that this would be the right place and the right time.
So this exhibit is similar to an escape room where people find clues and solve puzzles to get out of a locked room. How would you describe it?
I like to refer to it as an inverse escape room. Once we do arrive back 200 years to Rembrandt Peel's study, there is no specific puzzle to be solved. The puzzle element of the room happens in the first room of the exhibit, which we call the Escapement Time Travel Agency, which has been established at the Peel in order to maintain our 200-year time machine. machine to handle time travel tours and to distill the necessary fuel to run the time machine. And the reason I call it an inverse escape room is that participants have to solve a puzzle in order to activate the time machine for them to be able to actually travel back in time. So as opposed to being locked into a room and having to solve a puzzle to get out, in this experience, you have to solve the puzzle to get in.
Your background is as a magician. How did you get involved in museum work?
For many, many years now, I've been telling people that if they ask me what I do, that I'm a storyteller and magician. And I really think of myself as a storyteller first. I got interested in magic when I was 7 years old. And by my early teens, I started to realize that magic was an amazingly effective tool to explore ideas and tell stories. And thus began my path as a storyteller. And really, my first major museum work was at the end of 2017, when I started working with the Jewish Museum of Maryland to curate the exhibition, which just closed earlier this week, Inescapable, The Life and Legacy of Harry Houdini. And this really shifted my path in life. It was really spending 3 days at the New York Public Library with unlimited access to their archives and manuscripts and digging through papers that I realized that this could perhaps be my calling in life. And I started for the first time, as opposed to creating worlds based purely on my imagination, which I had done for 20 years, I started building worlds on top of these already existing stories. And so about a year ago, I started working with the Peel Center to help manage the operations of the museum. And I think that there's just something amazing about the history of the Peel, in particular, the Peel family, and this opportunity to be working to transform the oldest building in America built to be a museum into the newest kind of museum. And so thus, in the last year and a half, I've become a museum person, which I really just see as another form of storytelling and an extension of what I've done throughout my life.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Kass speaking with David London, creator of the interactive exhibit at the Peel Center, where visitors are transported to the study of artist Rembrandt Peel of 200 years ago. So you fell in love with research. What research went into creating Rembrandt Peel's study?
Well, I can tell you, I never thought, if you had asked me 2 years ago, that I would know so much about the years 1818 and 1819 as I do today. We're fortunate that there is so many lingering documents from the Peel family. The American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia holds all the Peel papers. Yale University Press published a book of all the collected letters of the Peel family. So there's a lot of research and information that can be found about the Peels in general. There was a major exhibition that took place at the Peel Museum in the 90s, the last major exhibition there, called Mermaids, Mummies, and Mastodons, which was an exploration of the emergence of the American Museum. And so that was a lot of the research I did specifically into the Peels and what was going on. And fortunately, there's been many researchers before me that were able to leave documents behind that really assisted me. But then I also did research into what was going on in Baltimore and what was going on in Maryland and what was going on in the world in 1818 and 1819.
You actually immersed yourself so much that you changed the exhibit according to the month that you're sharing it with visitors?
So even though we're back 200 years, we are back 200 years moving forward in real time. So for example, when the exhibit opened in November, there was a painting in progress that Rembrandt was working on, which he completed at the end of January. So at the end of January, that painting will come out of the exhibit because then it went on to its next destination and it will be replaced with the next painting he begins working on as the exhibit moves forward. There's documents. For example, he was one of the founding members of what was then the First Independent Church of Baltimore, now First Unitarian Church. So there's a really great etching I found of the building itself. But that etching wasn't made until 1819. And so that was not part of the exhibit until we got to January and we were actually traveling back to 1819. So we're moving forward in time, even though we are back in time.
What are some of the other artifacts people can see in the study?
There is a display about the sea serpent related to the 1817 sea serpent in Gloucester, Massachusetts, right off of Boston Harbor. And we know that there was a sea serpent in one form or another displayed at the Peel Museum in 1818. And so I have derived from that that Rembrandt became particularly interested in the sea serpent. So there's a whole display about that. A new invention at the time was the kaleidoscope, invented by Sir David Brewster in England in 1817. He applied for a patent, but due to a clerical error, it was able to be manufactured around the world. This was the very first personal amusement device. And I found a really great newspaper clipping from the Maryland Gazette in June 1818 stating that Rembrandt Peale not only had kaleidoscopes on display at the museum for sale in the gift shop, but that he was also manufacturing kaleidoscopes. So there's a whole section in there devoted to the kaleidoscope and Rembrandt's obsession with that. We talk about gaslight. We talk about his chemical blowpipe experiments, his family's excavation of the first prehistoric animal in America, the mastodon exhumed from the Hudson River Valley in New York. So it really explores the Peale and specifically Rembrandt Peale's interests and obsessions during not only the years 1818 and 1819, but the years prior to that as well.
Sounds really interesting. Thanks for telling us about it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
David London is Director of Operations at the Peale Center and creator of Time Travel Tours. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we have information about this tour available through March 3rd, as well as other events at the Peale Center, 225 Holiday Street in Baltimore. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you've been listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.